listening to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley away in L.A. for a good cause. Jason Rantz from KTTH filling in quite well.
In Seattle for a good cause.
Yeah, that's right. So the big story, it's a national story, maybe even an international story, but it's also a local story because it involves our one and only Jeff Bezos. Yesterday, this broke after our show was on the air yesterday, but Jeff Bezos is in a kind of a war with the National Enquirer and American Media Research or Institute or something, headed by David Pecker. David Pecker is friends with Donald Trump. He was the guy who helped engineer buying one of the mistresses, the accused mistresses of Donald Trump, to buy her story and then squelch it as an effort to help Donald Trump. And the Mueller investigation has looked at his involvement, and they've been given a sort of a immunity case, so they will not bring charges against him for this particular incident involving Mr. Trump. And I think it was Karen McDougal. But it's only as far as what they've done up hitherto. And now Jeff Bezos is accusing National Enquirer, for just to keep it simple, of basically trying to extort him, to blackmail him into dropping his investigation of how all those salacious text messages made it into print a few weeks ago.
Well, and to go one step further than that, right? I mean, they demanded that in exchange of us keeping a whole bunch of dirty photos private, you have to put out a statement in the Washington Post that indicates that we did not approach you or this investigation for political gain. What's being deemed as extortion, according to Jeff Bezos, and these are his words, because he wrote a rather lengthy piece at Medium.com, which is basically a spot where people can post individual blogs. And
right.
It's been confirmed it actually came from Jeff Bezos, because people are like, this doesn't sound like something a CEO would do, certainly not Jeff Bezos. But he basically printed all of, he says, the emails that he received between the National Enquirer and their lawyers and him and his team over at Amazon. And part of this was a long list of X-rated photos that the National Enquirer says they have. And it's detailed very plainly in this email.
And we're going to go through some of those the explicit descriptions for one reason only, not for salacious interest, but for me, when I first read it, you'll read them for salacious reasons maybe, but not me.
Can we get the music ready?
What we're doing, what Jeff Bezos said is he was accusing the National Enquirer of basically extortion, but it was his interpretation of that. And it wasn't until I actually read the interchange between the two of them that he posted, assuming that those are accurate, I can't imagine he would make all this stuff up, that I began to realize I think this could be seen as more explicitly extortion or blackmail than not, because they not only said, hey, we've got incriminating photos of you, they went into great detail about what they are. For instance,
you want me to just do it?
Just a
shirtless Mr. Bezos holding his phone in his left hand while wearing his wedding ring. He's wearing either tight black cargo pants or shorts, and his semi-erect manhood is penetrating the zipper of said garment. So it's getting really, really graphic. They go on to say, now I have to turn off the music because I feel uncomfortable.
Okay,
a full-length body selfie. A full-length body selfie where he's got his phone in his left hand while wearing briefs. A selfie of Mr. Bezos fully clothed. That's all right. A full-length, scantily clad body shot with short trunks. A naked selfie in a bathroom wearing his wedding ring. Mr. Bezos is wearing nothing but a white towel at the top of his pubic region that can be seen. And then, of course, also gets into his girlfriend or his mistress, however we want to deem it at the time.
Ms. Sanchez.
A photograph of her smoking a cigar in what appears to be a simulated oral sex scene, and then wearing a plunging red neckline dress, revealing her cleavage and a glimpse of her nether region. So it's basically they sexted back and forth, which is what a lot of people do in 2019 because they've got phones and they can't always be together.
In addition, and that's the preliminary to the initial one, which is below-the-belt selfies, so implying that they have genitalia shots of both of them. And the fact is, and then so after they do this list, then it says, it would give no editor pleasure to send this email. I hope common sense can prevail. And quickly, that does sound vaguely threatening. And the idea is, we didn't read the
it's offices. A negotiation.
It is a negotiation, but it does feel like a shakedown. And so I was glad that I read those the specificity of it, because I feel like, there does seem to be more of a threat than just this kind of general, hey, lay off, you know, or you're going to regret it kind of stuff. You, however, thought that my interpretation was not your interpretation.
I didn't originally view it as a threat in a traditional way, because what we didn't say is part of the email exchanges between the company and Bezos was also from a lawyer. And in that context, a lawyer supervising and, in fact, emailing on behalf of the company brings up two points. Number one, anything a lawyer puts in writing seems threatening. No matter what they do, it always seems threatening. Now, part of that is just part of the legal process.
Legalese,
it's supposed to seem a little bit threatening because they want you to stop doing something, what they believe is illegal or whatever. And number two, the lawyer, which people are not talking enough about this, used to work at Amazon for well over, I believe, a decade or almost two decades. John Fine is his name. So he is a former Amazon employee. And this whole idea.
So how does that affect things, though?
Well, here.
Because it still is, whether it was him or not, it adds a fascinating detail, I realize. It's very gossipy. Oh, my God. They basically hired a guy from Amazon's own camp to do this dirty business if it's dirty business.
For me, it brings up, is there nefarious intent? Is he out to get Jeff Bezos? Is this a good opportunity because Bezos maybe was a bad boss or whatever? Mm. Or is it quite the opposite, which is, this isn't extortion at all. This is a lawyer who presumably knows a thing or two about the legal world and isn't going as far as legitimately extorting someone into something, right? I mean, this could very likely be protected free speech saying, we're just putting out an offer.
Okay, wait. Yeah, no, I agree. But he did not sign the salacious one. That was
correct. But this was the follow-up because he came up with an email with proposed terms, which was based on that original, quote-unquote, salacious email, right?
That's right.
I cannot imagine that in all of this, they purposefully wrote something that can be easily deemed extortion. I just find that hard to believe, unless that they were so gutsy saying, you're not going to go public with this because of all the details. Bezos is happily going public.
That's the way blackmail and extortion usually works, is people are too scared.
But you don't put it in writing by a lawyer,
speaking. But I'm wondering if the lawyer, since it appears, we don't know this for sure, but it appears he wrote that second, if he didn't write that letter as a way to cover for what clearly looks like extortion the first time out. Anyway, it makes for a very juicy story. And the idea here is that now there's going to be a federal investigation of Jeff Bezos's charges, I guess, or accusations. At this point, National Enquirer is saying is they did nothing wrong. They did nothing illegal, that they can say whatever they want to say in their print. There is a kind of First Amendment principle here. The problem is this is not First Amendment if it looks like it's extortion, and I don't know how you'll end up determining.
Not if it looks like extortion. That doesn't mean anything. Yeah, exactly. If it's extortion. And again, because a lawyer is involved, my sense is it's probably careful enough. To us, it looks shady, right? Yeah. I mean, and it does look shady.
I'm sure.
Even if it's
shady.
Totally
it
legitimate.
Might be illegal.
It looks really shady. And, you know, they wanted to get something that presumably National Enquirer believes that they weren't politically motivated. Yeah. And that's what's in it for them is, look, we don't want to do this because this probably goes a little bit too far, but we're willing to do this unless you stop going too far and making these accusations of political motivation.
First of all, I think it was pretty ballsy for Bezos to go this way.
You can't
I mean,
use
it was
that term in relationship.
I just
to this
did.
Email.
The idea is, I think he basically called, you know, their Trump. I mean, the idea is that they threatened him, whether it's illegal or not, it was kind of a threat. And he says, I'm not taking that bait. And because of that, I think National Enquirer or David Pecker may be in more trouble again, because now, who knows, Mueller might reopen his investigation and say, wait a minute, is this politically motivated? Because right now, Bezos is trying to figure out how did they get that access to those pictures and those texts? And the suggestions were, last week, John and I talked about this. Well, the initial one was somebody hacked his phone. He hired a team to look at it, and he said, we can't establish any kind of hacking. Then the second thing was his girlfriend, that maybe she, in an effort to release this to get him to break up with his wife,
maybe.
Which ended up happening, and he says they kind of dismissed that. So the last thing they were looking at was whether it was politically motivated. If they can establish a political motivation that they actually made contract through the White House or someone tangential to Trump, then that could bring back the whole Mueller investigation back onto David Pecker again.
Apparently, that's what the Bezos camp tends to believe, according to the Washington Post.
Because they've ruled out the first two,
Well, and they say they've ruled out the first two, but also keep in mind that during this Bezos portion of the investigation into the leaked photos, they thought that Sanchez's brother was responsible or had some sort of...
Yes, well, that would have been theory number two. And apparently, I mean, we're like way too far away from this, but Amazon's investigator said, that didn't seem to be the case as well. But we'll sort of see.
The investigation into his lover did not determine that she was responsible.
Yeah, but can you imagine?
She also has a if you were that lover, how, Trump administration.
Yeah, but how would you feel if you thought that your lover was investigating you for leaking this stuff?
But how about this? What
if that could chill a relationship pretty quickly?
I imagine that if I get into a relationship with a celebrity or an important person, and I at the initial part of this relationship, I don't think it's going anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's that I don't assume it's going to go anywhere. So. Hey Tom, look who I'm dating. Look what I and then maybe that's how
it
got
out.
That's certainly a possibility.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. Hey, this is just to wrap this story up. This is a Washington Post reporter, Manuel Roig Franzia on MSNBC, talking about what they've learned about the leaked messages so far.
We have spoken extensively with his security consultant, and he's provided us with some very interesting insights into the backstages of this whole drama, including the investigation that has taken place in which they have begun to believe the Bezos camp that this publication by the National Enquirer might have been politically motivated. I would just add one other thing. You mentioned hacking at the top of the show. Gavin DeBecker told us that he does not believe that Jeff Bezos's phone was hacked. He thinks it's possible that a government entity might have gotten hold of his text messages.
Okay, yeah, but so again, how did they get it?
That's right, yeah.
Did they break into the phone? Is this the NSA being used for nefarious intent?
Well, that would make even a better story. I don't think anyone thinks that so much, but it could have been, in effect, leaked or sloppily handled, and that they got access to it. Okay.
Should they print the pictures?
So the other big story. Don't you think somebody eventually will?
Yeah, I mean, if it's out there, it's going to be printed.
Yeah. So
I think Bezos is probably taking a position of, look, it's mildly embarrassing, but it's not that embarrassing.
Yes. In fact, there is some scuttlebutt that he might be proud of what could come out in those pictures. Oh, my God. Let's move on. Although I do think if the pictures do come out, we may bring you on as a special feature of the Tom and Curly Show to describe each of the photos.
Sure.
You did such a good job of
but
reading
I can
the,
rate and everything as well.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Okay, the other big story, national story, that doesn't have as many local ties, but at least it's being covered, and it's covered on all the cable news shows right now, is Matthew Whitaker, who is the acting attorney general, is testifying before Congress. We've got a bunch of clips. I just want to kind of get through these. I think both of us agree on, although we're on opposite sides of the issue and opposite sides on our take on Matthew Whitaker, that this is the very definition of political theater.
It's all political theater. Anytime you have any of these committee hearings, it's political theater. Whoever's behind it.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that it needs to be dismissed, but we are certainly aware of the fact. Yeah, now that it's a Republican under the spotlight, it's easier to dismiss for you. But anyway, we do both acknowledge that is what's happening. This, we'll start off with Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler asked Attorney General Matthew Whitaker about any conversations he's had with Trump about the Mueller investigation. Naturally, remember, before he was a named acting Attorney General, he had come out and dismissed the entire Mueller investigation as a waste of time.
I'm sorry. It's a yes or no question. Have you communicated anything you learned in that briefing about the investigation to President Trump, yes or no?
Mr. Chairman, as I've said earlier today in my opening remarks, I do not intend today to talk about my private conversations with the President of the United States. But to answer your question, I have not talked to the President of the United States about the special counsel's investigation.
Okay, it was a semi-denial. I mean, there's enough wiggle room that if he did.
He flat out denied it. I mean,
He didn't, because he said, I did not talk about the investigation, but that doesn't mean that he didn't pass on, you know, information. I don't know. It was a little squirrely what he was saying. But anyway, moving on. Later, Nadler asked
another question. He didn't technically say he sent a direct message via Twitter to Trump, and maybe that's his out. Come on.
Well,
he said no.
Then why did he refuse to say it? See, what's interesting about that is, and again, it's legalese, and I understand why lawyers have to respond.
It's not so much legalese per se, right? I mean, so the context behind the scenes of this whole thing is that they want to be able to exert executive privilege down the line if Trump should want to do that. And so no one wants to say anything about private conversations, which for the most part has been regardless of who's in the White House, has been a respected position for these individuals to take, that I have to be able to give free advice to these individuals without it becoming public.
It just has to be invoked, and they've refused to invoke it, and so that raises the issue. Well, just again, this is Adler again asked another question about the investigation Whitaker tried an interesting tact to avoid answering.
In your capacity as acting attorney general, have you ever been asked to approve any request or action to be taken by the special counsel?
Mr. Chairman, I see that your 5 minutes is up, and so
Nadler is laughing.
I'm here voluntarily. We have agreed to 5-minute rounds. And
the committee,
I think that's a fine place to end the 5-minute rule.
The committee will end. We'll come to order.
He's smiling when he's saying that. So
okay.
It wasn't taken as.
So it wasn't taken as I'm a jerk and I can be a jerk and you can't do anything to me.
No, I think. Okay. But here's the deal: when you've agreed to these types of things, generally you're supposed to adhere to it, and generally yes. We do. Now, in that case, should he have just finished the quest and then moved on?
Yeah.
Yes, he didn't. He was having a little bit of fun here, but also remember the context is. For 5 straight minutes, Nadler kept trying to get him to answer yes or no questions, which is a dishonest strategy to get someone to buy into a narrative, and he did not want to do that.
That was the first cut. The second cut, he wasn't trying to get a yes or no answer
for
out of him.
The first 5 minutes, okay. I watched the entire... It's not that long. That's
you,
all it was.
You do like this Whitaker guy.
Oh,
okay,
so, fun.
So Whitaker eventually answered that question after he made that smart-ass remark.
I want to be very specific about this, Mr. Chairman, because I think it's going to allay a lot of fears that have existed among this committee, among the legislative branch largely, and maybe among some American people. We have followed the special counsel's regulations to a T. There has been no event, no decision that has required me to take any action, and I have not interfered in any way with the special counsel's investigation.
Now, just for the sake of making my
That's
point,
nice to hear.
That is a better response than simply a yes or a no.
Yes.
Now, he could have said no, and then it would have been, well, it was not a total denial, because what about this?
Yes, so I agree.
That's why, and you and I talked about this off air.
Yes.
I don't like, and I know you don't as well, regardless of whether it's a Republican or a Democrat doing it, doing these silly yes or no statement questions, because there's context that's incredibly important.
Absolutely. But it's not silly because it's a legal device to build a case, and so you get yes and no answers. I know why they're doing it.
This
a lot
of court
them,
of law. This
no,
is a
I know, but a lot of them are lawyers. But I agree. It makes me uncomfortable because I imagine being on the other end of that, saying, wait a minute, if I say yes, the implication
you're
gonna
take it of
this
out of context.
Is going to be, such that,
and that,
so
and
I
that's
agree.
A problem. And so for that, I'm actually glad that Whitaker, regardless of what you think about his politics or the Trump administration, I'm glad that he didn't make it really easy for anyone to just create their own narrative. Because they're already creating the narrative by having this theater, right? I mean, they're trying to implicate the president again in a cover-up with Russia and collusion with Russia. And they're, only picked Whitaker because he's
oversight.
Friendly.
Yeah.
But it's just because he's friendly to your cause.
That's the
narrative. Though, but there's no evidence to suggest that Whitaker did anything to get involved in derailing the
Mueller investigation. The only evidence is that he's eminently unqualified for his position. And because of that, he was named.
Yeah, to you.
And here, we ran out of time. I wanted to play. We did hear from a Republican, Doug Collins, who called the whole hearing a waste of time. We'll just have to assume that he said it eloquently and move on for the next segment.
Oh, how weird you choose not to play the Republican.
No, I'd love to play it. Do you want me to play it? I'd be happy to. We'll go in late.
On Thursday, Bill Barr was approved out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. By next Thursday, he will be the Attorney General. This gentleman right here is finishing up the last term of acting Attorney General. He's willing to come, but yet we had the charade yesterday. This hearing is pointless. There's plenty of frustration of issues of DOJ oversight. But, sir, I'm not sure, frankly, that the oversight of your financial situation from 2014 to 2016 has anything to do with this hearing.
It you doesn't. Happy?
I'm Jason Rantz. I'm filling in.
What? Jacob producer is mad at us.
I'm Jason Rantz. I'm filling in for John Curley. You're listening to the Tom and Curley Show. When we come back, the biggest movie of the weekend will get 10 seconds of mention, and the movie that no one will see or care about and will probably forget 10 minutes from now will get 8 minutes.
Wait till they hear me. Welcome back to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley away, Jason Rantz from KTTH filling in. By the way, Muckleshoot Bingo Know-It-All Contest, that is today. John is out, however, so he won't be doing the know-it-all quiz, but we'll still give away that prize. Brought to you by Muckleshoot Bingo. For this week's winner, it's your chance to win 2 tickets to Seattle Opera's The Revolution of Steve Jobs. I can't wait for this. This is a brand new opera, and for those people who think that operas go on too long, I think I've heard that this is like 90 minutes. It's a brand new modern opera.
This seems like one that someone who maybe says no to opera just by habit
yes.
might... open up someone's eyes to the opera.
Exactly. Right?
I think this is a great idea.
One can only hope, and I think it might even have been commissioned by Seattle Opera and a couple of other
Michael Fassbender occurs. Is leading this crowd.
No. Although that was a great, great movie on Steve Jobs. Okay, that's what happens when Jason and I get together. Sure, we disagree on politics, but we talk movies endlessly. Whether we agree or disagree, we both love movies and talking about movies. And so we're going to take advantage of this segment. Normally, I do my movie review at
47.
And John walks out. Now, Jason has agreed to sit through my review. However,
take us through the blockbuster of this weekend, please.
He's not exactly thrilled with my choice of movies this week, but I want to kind of sort of suck you into listening for this main reason, and that is the Oscars. Do you realize they're only 2 weeks away, Jason?
I do.
So everyone has to,
February
24th. So everyone has to do their due diligence to try to see as many Oscar-nominated movies as they can. Well, these are some Oscar nominees that you might not have heard of, and I'm going to talk about one of them specifically, but the entire category as well. And that is, in terms of actual sheer quality, I think the most packed Oscar category this year is also one of its most obscure. Yes, Best Foreign Film. Yes, we're going to talk about that. Now, with the Oscars telecast, new 3-hour time limit. I wonder if this category is even going to make it on the air. They say a lot of these awards are not going to be presented live. They'll be kind of recapped, leading into and coming out of commercials, but we'll have to see. But it doesn't mean that those five nominees for Best Picture in the Best Foreign Film category they've never been so highly honored. That's what I want to kind of introduce people to.
And foreign language film, because if it was foreign film, this annoys me, because we've got an actual movie. What was this? My favorite movie, the Stalin movie.
Yeah, Death of Stalin.
Death of Stalin.
Yeah,
it's in English. It's a British film. It should be counted as a foreign film.
We both vote for these movies, and I laughed when I saw that in a foreign language category because it was a British film. I just rolled my eyes. Oh, you poor fool, Jason. But anyway, it's just called Best Foreign Film, but it's foreign language films. Anyway, I think most of us, if you're following Oscars at all, you've probably heard of the Mexican entry, because that's Roma. And not only is Roma tied for this year's most overall Oscar nominations, an amazing 10, and includes high-profile nods like Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, Supporting Actress, Screenplay. It's also, actually, at least as of right now, 2 weeks before, the front runner for Best Picture, according to Entertainment Magazine and all the Gold Derby predictions. And that is amazing and astonishing to think that a black and white film with subtitles is now not only up for Best Picture, but a front runner. So that's the lead of the foreign film category.
It's going to win like La La Land.
The thing is, it didn't win. You know, last time there was a category like this, Pan's Labyrinth was nominated for Best Picture and was nominated for Best Foreign Film, and it didn't win. It was upset by another movie called Lives of Others, which comes around at the end of my review. So anyway, you got a front-runner Mexican entry that in the foreign film category. You also have a Polish film called Cold War. It's itself up for not just Best Foreign Film, but three Academy Awards, including the prestigious categories of Best Director and Cinematography. Speaking of prestigious, the third film, the Japanese film Shoplifters, has already won the Cannes Film Festival's Palme d'Or. That's the top award, and stands at 99% on Rotten Tomatoes. Another amazing thing. All three films, by the way, if you're wondering, are available to see in Seattle right now. In fact, Netflix has Roma because it was a Netflix production, but you can still see those three films, plus a fourth film called Capernaum that opens today. So you'll be able to see four of the five in Seattle starting tonight if you can avoid the snow. Capernaum is also a Cannes Film Festival winner and another multiple Oscar nominee, including for Best Cinematography. Okay, that's the setup. That's to get you energized about a category you hadn't heard of. And this is the review. So Capernaum, it tells a harrowing tale of a 12-year-old boy born into abject poverty, but making the best of it under the most dire of circumstances. Zane, the kid's name, he lives with a half a dozen or so of his siblings, three to a mattress, in this makeshift couple of rooms in the slums of Beirut. Now, none of the children goes to school because none of them was registered at birth because it was too expensive for their impoverished parents. So the kids spend their days selling their wares in the streets and or delivering store items for their shop owner / landlord. When Zane's cherished 11-year-old sister gets sold off in marriage to the landlord's son, his outrage knows no bounds. He runs away from home and is eventually taken in by a friendly but illegal Ethiopian immigrant, a working mother of a 1-year-old who lives in a shanty town just outside of Beirut. The bulk of the movie consists of Zane taking care of the toddler while his mother's away. Now, as their circumstances become more and more desperate, the street smart Zane becomes more and more industrious. He's a shining embodiment of the resiliency of youth in the face of anything. The darkness of Capernaum is undeniable, but so is the human spirit. Director Nadine Labaki has assembled a remarkably non-professional cast, most especially the boy playing Zane. He's an actual, in real life, Assyrian refugee in Lebanon who brings both the necessary gravity and natural charm to the demanding role. Equally brilliant is the one-year-old who interacts with Zane and his mother in the movie with uncanny presence. In some ways, Capernaum seems very contemporary, given how it depicts the ongoing political crisis of undocumented citizens, illegal immigrants, and international refugees, but it's the universality of the human experience and the compassion it elicits that comes to the fore and gives the film its real power. And then, by the way, just to wrap up my foreign film category, the fifth and final nominee for Best Foreign Film opens next week. Never Look Away, a German film made by Florian Henkel von Dommersmach, who's already won one Oscar for his masterpiece, The Lives of Others. Yes, the movie that upset Pan's Labyrinth oh so many years ago. And again, just to remind you, the Oscars are 2 weeks from Sunday. Okay, so that. Now, I have promised to allow... Jason also reviews movies. That's not that anyone would know. But you also review mainstream movies in addition to foreign films. So take away what most people are going to go see this week.
I think of it as an actual service to the audience, talking about the movies that they're curious about rather than the movies that they've not heard of at all under any circumstance and still can't probably spell the name of the movie you just said. What Men Want is the release. It's out today. Okay. It stars Taraji P. Henson. It's kind of a remake from a woman's perspective of What Men Want, which was the Mel Gibson, Helen Hunt film.
Which was a terrible movie about a decade ago.
It was really bad. About a decade ago, yeah. So in this case, very similar circumstance in which a woman who feels like she's being boxed out of advancement at her place of work. She happens to be a sports agent. She ends up hitting her head and wakes up suddenly able to hear the inner thoughts of only the men all around her.
Yeah.
And it basically goes along the way that you think. She learns about herself. She learns that maybe she's not being boxed out through sexism, but maybe because of how she portrays herself to a whole bunch of other people. And then you mix in the whole storyline.
So it's anti-feminist.
Well, it's not anti-feminist at all, but it's like it's a self-reflective movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, she deals with relationships that she is trying to engage in, both romantic and otherwise.
Okay.
And it hits all the notes that you expect it to hit. The one difference is it's actually kind of funny.
Really?
I enjoyed myself throughout this entire movie, and I was filled in an audience filled mostly with women. It was a woman's night out kind of movie. And this it feels that way, that if you're a woman who wants to do a traditional movie that generally is geared towards men, you're going to laugh out loud at the majority of this movie. For men, I think it's also incredibly accessible. This just happens to be a pretty decent comedy. Is it great? No. Are you going to remember it in a few months from now? No, but you will remember it than that movie you talked about.
Colin Kaepernick,
this untold story.
It's Lebanese. I'm sorry it has subtitles, but the acting is so great. You shouldn't let subtitles get in the way. In fact, subtitles disappear once you start watching the movie 5 minutes in.
What Men Want is out. I do recommend it. It's an enjoyable 90 minutes or so.
Yeah, it's just not nominated for an Oscar like my movie was.
Well, to be fair, this did come out after the nominations.
So we'll stay tuned next year.
I think Tracy Morgan might be in it for Best Supporting Actor.
Tracy
just
Morgan.
Throwing that out there. Oh, he's so bad. You're listening to Tom and Curly. I'm Jason Ransom, filling in for John Curly. If you like what you hear, you can tune in to me 3 to 6 on KTTH. If you don't like what you hear, who asked you? I didn't ask you to give me a review. When we come back, I generally side with cops, almost blindly side with cops. But there's something they're doing in New York having to do with a traffic app that I think goes one step too far. We're going to get into their latest efforts when we come back on Cairo Radio.
Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. Jason Rantz filling in for John Curly. He'll be back on Monday. So there's a story here about, in fact, we hoped to talk about it yesterday and we ran out of time. John is a big booster of Waze, which is Google's kind of traffic guide, let's say, an app that...
It's a GPS service.
Yeah, GPS service that allows... One of their features allows you to find out about police checkpoints. And it turns out that police are none too happy about that. In fact, the NYPD, which I think is the biggest police department in the country, has sent a kind of a cease and desist letter to Google, basically claiming, stop revealing the location of police checkpoints. You are interfering with us doing our job, which is to maintain the safety of the populace.
And it's interesting because originally, this is not the first time we've heard of a similar story. We've heard police officers take a claim that when you put this information out there, you are actually putting our lives on the line for potential people who might ambush us in some way.
Okay.
And so that didn't catch on in a meaningful way, at least. And so now they're switching it to, hey, when you tell people that we've got these officers stationed there, when they're trying to do checkpoints for drunk drivers, you're making it easier for drunk drivers to avoid us and thus be unsafe on the roads.
That's true.
And my position is exactly the same as it was before. I'm sorry that it makes your job harder. Believe me, I'm sorry about that. And I want drunk drivers off the roads as well. But this is clearly a case of free speech. They have absolutely every right in the world to put this information out there. You work for the public, and the public has the right to know where these either speed traps are or
I don't know. Okay.
They absolutely have the right to know.
So, and again, I don't have a dog in this hunt, so I'm just sort of asking questions. If you're doing an undercover job, I'm just asking you. If you're doing undercover work, does the public have the right to know that you're doing undercover work? No,
they
obviously.
They have the right to print it.
Deception.
Let's say I'm walking by and there's some like undercover sting operation. I happen to notice someone in a car. I can tweet that out.
Okay, no. What I'm saying is if this guy is doing something undercover and then you find that out and expose that guy who's doing undercover police work, that would be seen as interfering with police work. And I think the argument that you were using that the public has a right to know that he's doing this undercover work is
I'm saying they have the right to print it because it's done in the open. Right? It's done in the open. And just to use your argument, just from a legal perspective, I would happen to agree with what you posited there, which is, if I find this out, I have the right to publish it. I personally wouldn't because that is dangerous and it's wrong and it's immoral.
Okay.
But you technically have the right.
See, I don't know that you technically do have the right. If it's interfering with government operations.
I can tweet. What do you think is going to happen? Let's say I find out about this and I tweet it out.
Well, the idea is if you're interfering.
Arrest me?
I think, well, the thing, I don't know if it would be arrest, but it would be a stern warning.
Yeah, they get mad,
because,
which they should get
because,
mad.
Because,
if
you are somehow, you know, endangering a multi-million-dollar investigation into a terrorist plot and reveal something, I think you could be in trouble. But anyway, the issue here then is it's too bad. You agree that the cops have a gripe, but they don't have a legal leg to stand on.
Yes, and if I was Google, I wouldn't change it because this is a way that their service is different than all the other services out there. Because it's not only that you're able to indicate where there are cops, you can also indicate where there are car accidents. Now,
trying to get rid of Waze completely. They just want that one facet. Yeah.
But the way that I have used this particular service when I owned a car, and let's say I'm driving up I-5 and I'm going into the Everett area, and there generally are a lot of cops there waiting to get speeders, I correct how fast I'm driving. I go slower. And so it has the right effect in getting me not to avoid the area, but to slow down.
That's Google's argument. Informing drivers about upcoming speed traps allows them to be more careful and make safer decisions when they're on the road.
But it's absolutely true. As a user,
I understand that. I do think that a speeder and a drunk driver, they're seen as different categories.
Do we think the drunk driver who is capable of pulling up this app and then finding this specifically out? I find that a little hard to believe.
I know. Well, see, that's what I wonder. I wonder if they have evidence that that's actually done. But
yeah, I'm sure the guy said, I was driving drunk the other day, but you know how I avoided any sort of
punishment? Why would the cops object?
Because I think they just do not like this in a general sense, and they're coming up with it. I'm Jason Rantz. That is Tom Tainey. It's a Tom and Curly show right here on Cairo Radio.